we've developed this intervention called the Zoo, and basically it's this screen on the wall. It runs all the time. Every time I look at it, I see something new, and I've seen it dozens of times, but it's basically moving animal portraits. So these very beautifully filmed, slightly slowed down portraits of animals just moving, looking at the viewer. And there's about, I think there's about an hour and a half of content. So we've done a study in terms of looking at the impact of this, and we've got a randomized control trial running at the moment, but we're taking bloods. Before we had this intervention, it could be up to 7 minutes to take bloods. With this intervention, that's dropped to under 3 minutes. There's also been, and this is a clinician-reported study before we've done the randomized control trial, was an 87% reduction in perception of pain.
Hello and welcome to the Not Meanie Adults podcast, pioneers for children's healthcare and well-being. This is episode 11 of season 2. My name is David Cole, and once again I'm joined by my wife Hannah, and together we are the co-founders of UK children's charity Thinking of Oscar. This week we're speaking with Tristan Hawkins from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London. Tristan is the art director and patient environment director and works for the hospital charity known as CW+. Tristan is responsible for leading the vision for arts and design for CW+, in order to provide a first-class environment for everyone using the hospital. In our conversation, we discuss the value of evidence-based design and how that impacts patient experience, as well as paediatric patient distraction techniques that the hospital has employed, and finally, how art has the ability to foster patient well-being and relationships. We had such a fascinating conversation with Tristan, and we hope you enjoy and take away as much from it as we did. Tristan, hi. Thank you so much for joining us on the Not Mini Adults podcast.
Hello, yes, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're delighted to have you on. And I think the conversation that we're going to have today is going to be slightly different to some of the ones that we've had previously. There's definitely themes that go through our podcast, and I guess patient experience is one of them. Obviously so important when it comes to children and children being in that kind of environment of a hospital setting. So, you know, we'll absolutely, you know, delve into that and understand what you're doing in Chelsea and Westminster. But maybe if you could start, as we tend to do, just talking a little bit about yourself and how you got to be doing what you're doing and, you know, what that involves, please.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. So my kind of education was fairly kind of unusual. So I actually didn't go to school for much of my childhood. We lived abroad. We lived in France and then Scotland. And we kind of were quite nomadic as a family. And so my kind of career path has been quite random. I had a real interest in the kind of the environment. And I spent quite a number of years working with horses. So I actually My plan was to be a professional eventer, riding horses and also training horses. I did that for about 3 years until I was, I think, 17. And then I was kind of really gripped by going into medicine and in particular veterinary science. So that was my plan, but I had absolutely no qualifications. So I went to, I think it was a technical college, that's what it was called then, and started trying to get the different qualifications that I needed to go to university, which was a real challenge. And in that kind of process, decided that, you know, actually I wasn't very academic. I have quite severe dyslexia. So that was a real challenge at that time because it wasn't really recognized. So I went into the arts, which again, I had a real interest in. So went to art college, did an MA in filmmaking actually in Berlin, and then came back to the UK and was quite kind of socially engaged. So I was kind of working with Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and organizations like that. And was interested in terms of how you could use the arts to be kind of socially engaged. So then I worked with young people at risk worked with people with disabilities, but trying to work within the mainstream. So really what I was doing was trying to work with groups that might have been excluded from working within mainstream arts. And at that time, that was quite unusual work. Now it's very commonplace, but yeah, this was kind of in the late 80s, early 90s. So that kind of led me to working more mainstream within the visual arts, which is really where I've been working since that time. So of leading arts organisations, working across art forms often. And I had a job in Cambridge, which was running an art centre. And as part of that, we did a major capital development around the centre. And that got me really interested in built environment in terms of architecture and how spaces made people feel. And as part of kind of leading the programme at the Arts Centre, which is called Rising Arts, we did a lot of collaborations with kind of science and research that was taking place in what was called Silicon Fen, you know, in and around Cambridge. And one of those projects was working with Papworth Hospital, and we had an artist called Jordan Baseman who was doing a moving image-based project looking at people that were having heart transplants. And as part of that process, I spent a lot of time kind of shadowing him, working with him within an operating theatre environment, which was really challenging because I think, you know, me, like a lot of people, you know, when you go into the hospital, they're quite unnerving spaces, you know, just things like the lighting or the smells, the wayfinding, the colours, and that really struck me because I was doing this work with the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment in terms of creating a fantastic new art centre, and then going into these hospitals, it was pretty awful, and it made me feel really uneasy. So that kind of really started an interest in terms of built environment, in terms of how that can affect people, and in particular around kind of healthcare buildings. So following on from that job in Cambridge, I went down to the southwest to work on a major new development of new hospitals in Exeter, Plymouth, Devonport and Truro. So that was really looking at how we could kind of maximise design as well as integrating the arts. But to be honest, most of the work that I was doing was around design, so things like colour and lighting and acoustics, those things that often don't get factored into projects within the NHS. And then from that role, I went back into mainstream arts. So I was running the Royal Academy of Arts in Bristol, you know, really old organisation with a big collection and 130 academicians. And then was approached about the work at Chelsea. So Chelsea is a fascinating environment, you know, in terms of its work within arts and health. It has a real track record, but in terms of its role within healthcare, it was one of the first hospitals to be set up in the UK. So it's over 300 years old. It opened, I think, in 1719. So it was one of the first charitably run hospitals to be established in the capital, London. It was then called the Westminster Hospital. And in the late 80s, they were looking to kind of consolidate a number of hospitals onto the site that we currently occupy. So that was a brand new hospital. It was quite forward thinking. They had a really great team of architects that worked on it called Shepherd Robson. And they developed a building which opened in 1993, which was kind of really pushing the envelope. So, you know, when you go into the space, even today, it feels very different to a lot of hospitals. It's very light, it's very airy. One of the things that they wanted to consider in terms of developing the space was that you could open any internal window and get fresh air. It's got a very kind of sophisticated air handling system, which was also very sustainable in that it was bringing in air from the outdoors into the central atrium without using a lot of mechanical engineering. So the building is kind of flooded with light, big open spaces. And the other really important thing was that they kind of thought about artwork, you know, as they were building the new building. So, you know, there were huge sculptures built into the foundations, and there's over 2,000 works of arts, you know, within the clinical areas, but also within the atrium space.
And one of the things that as I was doing the research was that, am I right in saying that the hospital is actually has museum status?
We used to have museum status. So when I joined, we'd spent quite a lot of time becoming an accredited museum. You know, and as a curator, I thought, oh, that's fantastic. I was coming from my previous job, which was also a museum. And I was thinking, well, hang on, we've got over 600 works in storage, which because we were a museum, it was really complex to deaccession those. We couldn't just sell them or dispose of them. We had to go through a really long process. And we were spending a huge amount of time and money being a museum. And I thought, well, hang on, you know, we are here, our primary function is around hospital, and it's about the experience for patients, families, and the staff working for us. And was this the best use of resources? I think the other thing I was interested in was we have a collection, and you know, we've got some really valuable works within that collection, which may have been great back in late 80s or 90s, but now we're quite tired. And how we might look at the collection as an asset, which we obviously invest in good art, we show it, but then perhaps when that's served its purpose, we monetize it and we sell it. So we've dropped the museum status. We still look after the collection to museum standards. But for me, that was really important. It was about, you know, the primary function is around optimizing the patient experience for people using the hospital. And hospitals change. Every year, something changes. You know, a space that we might have thought was kind of sacrosanct and wasn't going to change, you know, in 12 months' time, that will need to change because the building is an evolving organism. I think the other thing is we're really constrained with the footprint. We're located in, you know, an area which house prices are very high. You know, the surrounding landscape around the hospital is quite fixed, so we can't really extend beyond the current parameters of the building.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to say, for anyone that's listening that doesn't actually realise where the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital is in London, it's in a, you know, it's middle of London in a very, sought after district, as it were, and lots of residential and everything else nearby, a football stadium, as we discussed, and everything else. So yes, that the ability to, well, A, do as much change, I guess, as you have in the last kind of 300 years, not you personally, but the hospital in itself, and to try and maintain that kind of modern day attire, and to really look at, you know, what your patients are needing now, and be able to give them that environment, I think is, you know, it is a really great story in itself. And with everybody that we've spoken to, it's that kind of serendipity as to what brought you to the hospital and what you're doing now, which I think is really interesting. So can you give us an overview as to what your role is and how that's working, and, you know, the kind of patient experience element to it, please?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I kind of have two roles. So when I joined CW Plus, so I work for CW Plus, which is the charity that exists for Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. So essentially we're one team, but I'm paid for by the charity. So my role is as arts director. So we have a big arts kind of collection. We have over 2000 works. But then we also, I kind of have sort of two job titles, because I felt sometimes when I'm using arts director within an NHS environment, people go, why have you got an arts director? So I'm also director of patient environment, and I'll use those two titles in different ways if I'm talking to an arts audience or to a health audience. So I guess most of my work really is as director of patient environment. And what that means is how we can really maximize the experience for people coming in. And that's often through the built environment. So, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing is driven by capital schemes. But I think we will also kind of question, you know, looking from the outside, in terms of, yeah, the NHS may have been delivering a service in a particular way for, say, 20 years. Why is that? So, you know, one of the things I love about my job is when we're working on a new project, and perhaps I can give some examples. So, you know, for the past 4 years, we've been leading a program around critical care. So that's been around a new neonatal intensive care unit and an adult intensive care unit. So as part of that process, we were able to say, look, let's look at what's out there in terms of what's available within the UK, but also what's available within the world. So it's really not being constrained by parameters that might usually happen on an NHS project, where, you know, there's a set of standards that we build things to in the NHS. They're called hospital building notes, and they're kind of laid down by the Department of Health in terms of, yeah, the very functional elements of building space, what that needs to look and feel like. You know, I think there's a lot of learning which takes some time perhaps to filter into that way of working. So a lot of my role is really questioning and looking at best practice elsewhere, and then trying to translate that into something that can work within the NHS. The other thing that I'm really mindful of within everything that we're doing is the cost benefit. So you know, we know that things like arts and design are extremely valuable within healthcare settings, but often a lot of the reason those things aren't happening is because people think they cost more money. Whereas in reality, you know, my experience is that, you know, sometimes they don't cost any more money. It's just about being careful and perhaps taking more time and weaving that into the whole design process.
How do you prove out those that cost benefit part of your work?
So that is a challenge, and I wouldn't say we always get it right. So if we're looking at, say, something like one of the things that I'm really focused on is noise. So noise in hospitals. So, you know, something that, you know, struck me when I go into a hospital is how noisy they are, the effect that noise can have on people. But then you can think, well, hang on, how much are you going to measure the cost benefit of that? Well, you're probably not. You know, there is research that has shown that, you know, over a certain number of decibels, staff are more likely to make mistakes. And there's a study done in Boston back in 2013, which looked at what level the staff start making mistakes. And the noise level is actually quite low. I think it's around 38 decibels, which is not particularly noisy. So to actually measure that within the NHS would be, I think, very impractical. It wouldn't be an easy thing to do, but I know that that is a reality, that in a noisy, busy environment, people are more likely to make mistakes, and that will have a knock-on effect in terms of cost, in terms of perhaps people being given the wrong medicines or making mistakes, which could then have an impact in terms of mitigation or whatever. So I think, you know, the most tangible example of cost benefit for me at the moment would be, you know, where we're able to do things more quickly. And we've got a great project we've been doing in our paediatric A&E. So that was a project that we did a couple of years ago. So we've redeveloped the whole department. It's one of the largest A&Es in London. Runs from the front of the hospital to the back, so it's about 800 meters long. It's vast, really beautiful, and within that we've got a dedicated pediatric area with 16 treatment cubicles, and we've designed those so that they're really flexible, so we can do things like we can adjust the lighting levels, there's bespoke music, so we've got 8 different playlists that you can just press a button and that kind of immediately kind of creates a different sound. Within that space, you can change the volume level. But one of the most exciting things is we've got this thing called the Zoo, which is essentially, it's a portrait screen, roughly, I'm trying to think of dimensions, probably about 40 centimetres by 120 centimetres. And when we were doing consultation for the project, so, I mean, that's the other thing, is we're really democratic in terms of the way that we develop things. So we just spend time in a space. So typically that means, you know, I might put scrubs on, I'll do shifts, I'll spend different times of the week working in the space and just trying to understand what are the problems. And when I was doing that work, you know, we were talking to the children and young people about what they would like. And Harry Potter was kind of all of the rage at that time. One of the things, you know, that kids were saying was they'd love to have the kind of the moving Harry Potter portraits. And the other thing I noticed was that often when painful or unpleasant things were happening, you know, like taking bloods or even taking blood pressure, doctors were getting their phones out and finding a video on YouTube to show the kids to act as a distraction while they were doing things. And we thought, well, hang on, if we could build that into the environment, that would be really, really strong. So we've developed this intervention called the Zoo, and basically it's this screen on the wall. It runs all the time. Every time I look at it, I see something new, and I've seen it dozens of times, but it's basically moving animal portraits. So these very beautifully filmed, slightly slowed down portraits of animals, just moving, looking at the viewer. And there's about an hour and a half of content. So we've done a study in terms of looking at the impact of this, and we've got a randomized control trial running at the moment, but we're taking bloods. Before we had this intervention, it could be up to 7 minutes to take bloods. With this intervention, that's dropped to under 3 minutes. There's also been, and this is a clinician-reported study before we've done the randomised control trial, was an 87% reduction in perception of pain. So if we're going back to, well, what is the cost benefit? The cost benefit is the time we're saving. So we're able to take bloods more quickly. So we're halving the time, arguably. I think the other thing is the distraction that could be caused by siblings or parents, that there's been a huge benefit there as well in terms of focusing them on something else other than what's happening to them. So it's something that we are still working on, but that would probably be one of the most tangible examples that I could give you at the moment.
And I suppose you don't have to, well, you need to correct my assumption, but I was thinking you don't have to pull out the cost benefit for absolutely everything you do, because you can build credibility through that. And then other initiatives that you do that may be harder to, like the noise example that you cited, or everything that you described about, even with the noise piece, my examples are coming from children, but it'd be for any patient. If you're getting some decent sleep, then it's understood that that supports your healing process or your anxiety levels. And So the impact of reduced noise on the patients is significant in a different way than the impact of noise from the clinical side. But everything else that you described in the building space to do with the other senses, so lights or smells, how you make people feel, I can see that there's so much there that is intangible, but for the end-to-end patient experience from arrival to departure, could it, you know, change it, positive changes there could impact them in many ways.
No, absolutely. I mean, we have other projects which we're working on which have been kind of built in with that in mind, in terms of looking at cost benefits. So with the new neonatal intensive care unit, which has just opened, I mean, we're not completely open yet, so 2/3 of it is open and there's another third that's still being built. There we've really focused on the quality of the environment for neonates. So, you know, looking at the importance of natural light, again, of noise levels. So we've kind of optimized that whole environment. We've measured what the environment was like before, so we understand what it was like in terms of light levels, in terms of noise, temperature, air quality. And then over the next couple of years, we'll be measuring the change and then looking at what was actually happening to those babies. How are things different now? I'm pretty confident that we'll see a change for the better, but we don't know that yet.
You talked about being one team. I'm curious about, with everything that you've been describing, how you work with you're employed by the charity, but you're working hand in hand with colleagues in the hospital. Can you describe that dynamic for us, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is, you know, we have a fantastic team at Chelsea. You know, I think people are really open to different ways of working, and you know, when I was thinking of taking the job, I came down and met, you know, different people, and that was one of the key attractions to work there. Was, you know, we've got a pretty unusual team, so we will often come up with some quite wacky ideas, and I think there's a real openness to kind of to experiment, to try new ways of working. So I think, you know, the way that I work is very, you know, we're kind of very hands-on, so of getting to know as many different people, of building relationships, which, you know, could be with yesterday I was with the chief exec for the hospital. You know, I'm in regular contact with her, but equally with porters or the healthcare assistants. I find nothing better than putting on scrubs and just immersing yourself in an environment, because people will talk to you in a different way. And I think that's been really good, I think, in terms of building respect and people understanding what we're doing. I think the other thing is, the artists and designers that we're working with, that's one of the key qualities that I look for in them, is that they're really good communicators. You know, some of the ideas that we're working with might be quite kind of the higher end of contemporary art, but of finding a way of presenting that to people that may not be as experienced of that world. They may not go to galleries. So for me, that is, you know, the most successful way of working. And certainly in terms of the team that I work with, in terms of the people that we're bringing in, that's a key quality. I think the other thing is time. You know, it takes time to build relationships, and of allowing for that within projects. You know, give you an example. We were working with an artist, a British artist called Isaac Julian, who does, you know, absolutely stunning video installations. His work is quite challenging. It's quite political. And it probably took about 4 years to develop a piece with him, which would work within the hospital. It's within the atrium. It's a big five-screen installation of moving image. It kind of runs continuously. And I was kind of slightly unsure as to how that would work within the environment, but it's been really well received and people love it. I think, you know, to have a piece like that, which could be by, you know, an artist who's exhibiting internationally, quite cutting edge work within that kind of environment, is absolutely fantastic. So I think of educating people to different ways of working. Equally, sometimes we you know, it doesn't go as planned, it goes wrong. So we're doing a lot of work with new technology and that doesn't always work. But I think, again, that's part of the process. We've been working with virtual reality for probably about 2 years now, and we've done about four different projects, and so far one of those has worked. And I think, yeah, that's acceptable. It's part of the way we work, and we kind of factor that in. The other thing we're looking at is robots. So we're working with robotic pets. So we have an intervention called Paro, which is an intervention developed in Japan. It's a furry seal, works particularly well with kind of pediatrics and older patients. And then we have another robot called Miro, and that's been less successful. But we're working with the team that have developed that in terms of how can we learn from that and modify it. And I think this is just part of working with those technologies that, you know, things like VR headsets, you know, the VR headsets that were available last year compared to now are so different in terms of battery life or connectivity. So that's a part of our work, and that comes under an umbrella of a program we call the Future Hospital.
So I was going to ask about the part, one of the strands, I guess, of the charity is the CW Innovation. So you're doing a lot around innovation. I mean, you've just described a couple of elements to it there. But how, I guess, how did that come about, and what have you learned through that?
So in terms of CW Innovation, you know, I have a strand of work within my program, which is called Future Hospital, and that's really looking at how we can use new and emerging technologies within a healthcare environment. So one of the components of that I've mentioned already, which is about understanding environment. So as part of understanding the environment, we've developed four different sensors. So we're looking at air quality, temperature, noise, and light. So those sensors didn't exist, and we worked with companies to develop a series of sensors which are cloud-based. So we're measuring those environmental factors every 5 seconds, building up a profile of a space. So I think, you know, the aim with that work is it gives us a really useful tool in terms of we can be using it within our hospital, but the ambition is that this can be something which is shared more widely within every hospital. So I think certainly in terms of some of the work that we're doing around new technology, it's about initiating, it's about testing, it's about building an evidence base, which we can then share. So a project like the zoo, which I mentioned, you know, we are now sharing that with other hospitals. We'll make sure it works and then offer that free of charge. So we're not charging for that work. We have another initiative which comes under that umbrella, which is called Relax Digital. And it's again, moving image based work. We have 60 hours of content and then different types of playlists for different types of environments. And again, we offer that content free of charge to other NHS hospitals or environments. And I've lost my train of thought, I'm sorry.
That's right. But you've in terms of sharing, you've published design standards as well. So a white paper around design standards, which I've looked through, and it's fascinating. And I think, you know, some of the things that you've talked about today are covered in it, but it's a, you know, it's a great kind of blueprint to give to anyone that's either looking to tweak the facilities that they've got, or, you know, there's actually quite a few new children's hospitals that are looking to be built or are being built in and around Europe in the coming years.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, we developed the design standards initially just to work within our own teams. So one of the things that we found was happening was, you know, estates teams or facilities would be working on a project, you know, sometimes we wouldn't find out about them until quite late along, you know, that kind of process. So these were really agreeing a set of, you know, standards within the organization that we work to, you know, something like wayfinding, you know, is often quite bad in a hospital. So how can we just have consistency in terms of fonts that are used, size of signs, that kind of stuff. So the design standards really look at everything that goes into to a built environment. And as a standard that our organization works to, but, you know, we are now sharing that more widely. The other thing is, it's not static, so it is changing all the time. You know, we will hear of new things. So on our existing design standards, an area that we're doing more work on is around acoustics and learning from that. And, you know, as also new materials become available, that those can be kind of woven into it. So we share that work. There's a group called the National Performance Advisory Group within the NHS, and we're part of that. And this is a way that we can kind of disseminate that learning quite quickly. I think the other thing is that we have, you know, a range of different partners, you know, that we're working with. And, you know, so for example, the work around acoustics, we've worked with Arup for many years now, and also Foster's. So how we can kind of share some of that opportunity that we have that perhaps others don't have. Within that, we also have international partners that we're working with. So particularly around some of the work we're doing with new technology, we've got, you know, partners in Japan, China and South Korea. So it can be a way of kind of disseminating things that are happening internationally as well.
Does the scope of the work that you're doing interesting involve, and I'm thinking with patient experience, it might involve the participation of patients in art, actively producing art or being creative themselves, or is that the remit of a different part of the organisation?
No, so we have we've got kind of three strands to our work. So we have one which is around the collection and, you know, put kind of crudely is about pictures on walls. We've got Future Hospitals, which is around technology, and then another one which is called Arts for All. So this is around participation. So we have a team of artists who are coming in every day. I mean, obviously at the moment we're still kind of in COVID, so that's been challenging, but normally, more or less every day of the week, we would have something happening in terms of participation with a range of different patients, from, you know, children through to older people. And again, in terms of approach, that's also very broad. So yeah, one of the end of the spectrum, we've got dogs that we bring in. So we have kind of petting dogs that will come in, gardening, through to digital projects with patients making music at bedside. So that is a really, really important part of our work, is around process and engaging with patients. Often it's with patients that are with us for a longer period of time. So that's really important in terms of their rehabilitation, but also just kind of socialization, whether that's with an external person coming in or with other patients. So for example, you know, some of our ward areas have a 6-bedded bay. And often what we will be doing is a collaborative piece, which is engaging with those 6 patients that are sharing the same space together, because that will then have huge benefits when the artist leaves, in terms of, you know, at least they might know the name of the person next to them, they'll know a bit more, but it will have started a conversation which might not otherwise be there. I think the other really important part of that is it gives the staff skills which they can use in different ways. So that kind of softer side of nursing, which is around understanding people, you know, talking with them, you know, getting to know the families, which sometimes, depending on the environment, there isn't time to do that. So I think ways that we can help with that is really important.
I can understand that COVID could easily have inhibited and made it extremely difficult for you to continue that level of service over the last few months. Has there been examples where it's created a new opportunity, or has it simply been challenging times?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, COVID's been hugely challenging, but I think, you know, for me, one of the really positive things that I've seen come out of this is, you know, a sense of community in terms of within the hospital, and I think also within the wider community of people just looking out for each other. For us, practically, we've had to change the ways that we're working. So with the participatory work, we've developed a virtual strand of that work. So it's called Virtual Connections. So it's our artists creating work which exists online that patients can access, but equally doing things which are remote. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, we've been doing since June is live performances for patients in the hospital. So we'll have a musician who is in their home. You know, we will go into the ward area, we'll put on the PPE, and then we will facilitate an interaction between an artist who is remote and that patient. So, you know, one of the sessions I did a couple of months ago is with a patient, you know, had COVID, he was coming out the other end, been with us for 100 days. And yeah, he was quite lonely. He didn't really have any friends. He didn't have any family. He didn't have a smartphone. So, you know, his life was incredibly boring. You know, he was getting better, which was fantastic. But for him to be able to have that connection with the outside world was so important. With some of our pediatric patients, we've linked in with San Diego Zoo. So we have a live stream from San Diego Zoo into the pediatric areas. So it's not a two-way feed, but in terms of live content coming into that environment. So things like that, I think, you know, within COVID have been really positive. And I think also in terms of you're thinking, for example, like with our outpatient clinics, you know, 70% of those are now being delivered virtually, you know, through Skype or Zoom or whatever, yeah, which is brilliant because that can carry on. It just means that the hospital can run more efficiently and it's a better use of people's time.
We've just got a couple more questions. One of which is, what kind of feedback have you had from children, you know, specifically around, I mean, something that we have, you know, done quite a lot of work around is that distraction elements, is trying to make, you know, procedures a little bit easier for children. Last week, we were talking to someone that was Evelyn, who's doing a lot of work around VR and looking to bring that in. But, you know, specifically around the Zoo project or, you know, any of the other kind of interactive elements or distraction elements, what kind of feedback have you received from either the children or indeed the parents as well?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned already that, you know, our work is really driven by the people that we're using, that we're working with. So it's around finding kind of appropriate ways that you can engage with them. So we use kind of the formal groups that exist within hospitals, you know, patient public engagement teams. But a lot of our work is just about spending time in a treatment area or a waiting room and just talking to people. And sometimes we'll use questionnaires, but often it's about just talking to people. Also just observing the situation. So I think, you know, we're trying to make spaces as unfrightening as we can. We're trying to make them as domestic as we can. You know, if I just go back to the A&E project, we a really simple thing that the first meeting I had with the architects when we were developing the new unit was, I said, well, what are the acoustic properties for these treatment rooms? And they like kind of looked through the blank and said, well, there aren't any. The charity paid for ceiling tiles that had a property in terms of absorbing sound, and we were able to reduce noise levels throughout the whole of our A&E by 28%. So I think, you know, when kids are coming into that A&E, you know, it feels very quiet. We've got the different distractions within the space. We've also given them control over some things within that space, so things like the light, we've got the music. We've also got virtual reality that we're using within our pediatric A&E as well. So that's a tool which is available. So I think really it's about giving people control, allowing them to make some choices. The feedback that we get, you know, is always positive. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. Occasionally, you know, we have had, you know, perhaps some negative feedback about some artwork, and obviously then we've changed that. I think the other thing is also recognizing that, you know, you may do something and then, you know, it doesn't finish. You need to keep looking after that. So an example would be, we've got an area for relatives which, you know, it's where they have bad news. And we've learned from people using that space in terms of, you know, how it made them feel. And one of the things that came back was, you know, it wasn't warm enough. The air handling was too cold. So how can we physically warm up that space, but also kind of learn from the way that people have been in that environment and make it better? So, you know, I think as an organization, we never finish projects. We always go back and change them and redevelop them. And I think that's really important with technology, that you know, I've seen some really great projects around the country, but then after 12 months they break, and then, you know, the state's team don't have the time to fix them. And that is a reality of working within the NHS. So we take that responsibility in terms of looking after things and replacing things when they get broken or tired, or decommissioning them. So I think, yeah, it's really important to think about decommissioning when you're working on these types of projects.
Tristan, thank you so much. I think you've opened our eyes to you know, so many different kind of facets, and even as you were just describing, thinking about how the longevity of you know, technology that you put into a system or you know, into a paediatric unit or whatever it might be. But also, you know, as a charity, we're looking to bring, you know, the future of healthcare to children. And I think when people look at that, the connotation is, well, it's always going to be technology. It's always going to be, you know, the latest and greatest and, you know, the singing and dancing, whatever it might be. But actually, there are so many different elements to that. It's the latest research. It's the latest evidence. It's, you know, as you've described, just the artistic elements of it, trying to think how best to look after the patients and what they need and everything else. And I think, you know, for us, it's a fascinating conversation and something that, you know, what think we'll think about when we're looking at some of the projects that we're going to be doing into the future. The final question that we ask everyone that comes on the podcast is, if you had a magic wand and you could do anything when it comes to child health, what would that be?
So I think, you know, for me, it would be focused around giving children and young people some control, or an element of control, over the environment that they're in. You know, I think a lot of the things that we're doing are really simple, and they're not perhaps that expensive either. So I think the building in control, so for me, it would be around the environment that those children are in. Simple things like, you know, somewhere they can charge their phone, something where they can dip in the lights. I think would be fairly key to me.
Perfect. Thank you. Tristan, thank you so much for your time. You know, we really appreciate it, and good luck with all the work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us once again on the Not Mini Adults podcast, and a big thank you to Tristan Hawkins for joining us this week. Details of Thinking of Oscar and also the work that Tristan is doing with CW Plus will be in the show notes. If you know someone that you think that we should be talking to, or a topic that you'd like us to cover on the podcast, then please do get in touch. Next week is the final episode of season 2, before we take some time off for Christmas and then resume again in the new year. We're really excited about our final conversation, which will be with Dr. Todd Ponsky from the Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. Ponsky is a paediatric surgeon, but also Director of Clinical Growth and Transformation at Cincy Kids. And in his own words, he focuses on trying to find the least invasive way to solve a child's medical problem. We really hope you can join us again next week. Thank you.